I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, December 14th. It's a day when Mark Meadows, White House Chief of Staff on January 6th, has now been referred for a criminal contempt of Congress charge for defying a subpoena to say what he knew about coordination between the rioters and President Trump or his aides. Text messages from Meadows that were made public yesterday, have you heard this, include ones from three big Fox News hosts asking Mark Meadows to get President Trump to call the rioters off. For example, Laura Ingraham wrote, quote, "Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy," unquote. The New York Times notes, however, that on her show that night, Ingraham said no such thing and instead spread the false rumor that left-wing Antifa people were the rioters. She said, quote, "Earlier today, the Capitol was under siege by people who can only be described as antithetical to the MAGA movement," unquote. Wow. So if Chris Cuomo just got fired from his cable show for advising his brother on his scandals while recusing himself from the topic on the air, what should happen to Laura Ingraham for advising Trump on his and then lying on her show to cover up for him? So that's one story. Over in the Senate, with the Christmas recess about to start, Democrats are still trying to get President Biden's human infrastructure bill, child care, elder care, pre-K, climate protections, and other things passed their needed holdout. Joe Manchin, reportedly, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has been trying to convince Manchin to support the paid family leave provision in the bill, which she's been very involved in crafting. Senator Gillibrand joins us now on that and more for our monthly Call Your Senator segment. Hi, Senator Gillibrand. Happy holidays. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
So, Senator, if the report I read is accurate, how's it going with Joe Manchin and family leave?
Well, it's been a labor of love, and I started talking with Senator Manchin about 5 weeks ago, and he's come a long way. In our first meeting, he didn't know a lot about paid leave, and so now he not only understands what paid leave is and that it's for all family life events, whether it's a new child or a sick loved one or a dying parent. He also likes the structure that I originally wrote for the Family Act, which is an earned benefit that people would buy in across their lifetime. He wants it to be sustainable, and he wants it to be there for everybody and portable. So those are all really good signs. And so what I'm working on right now is this idea that what the House passed was the start of paid leave. It was 4 weeks of a universal benefit for all workers, for all life events. And I've tried to make the case to Senator Manchin that this is a great place to start because some states, like his own state, West Virginia, may never have a governor that wants paid leave. Many low-income workers or middle-income workers may never have an employer who's going to be willing to offer paid leave. And no matter how many incentives are offered to employers like through the tax code or how many incentives might be offered to governors to offer it, if you don't have those two willing participants, you may be out of luck. So this is one moment in time where we have a Democratic-only proposal to create universal leave for everyone that's an earned benefit. You have to work for at least a year to qualify. And so I'm suggesting to him this week that this is a chance. It's a moment in time that won't come around again for probably a long time, that you can guarantee your low and middle income workers at least 4 weeks. So when their parent is dying or when someone is disabled in their household or gravely ill or when a new child is welcomed into a home, that parent or that individual, that caregiver, can have the opportunity to meet the need of that loved one for 4 weeks, which, you know, in your own life, Brian, that can mean the difference of all the world to be with your parent before they pass, just before they pass, to be with a new infant, for a new mother to be able to nurse, to be able to walk again after childbirth. I mean, these are really Absolutely. Important things. And without paid leave, a lot of workers don't have the vacation time or don't have the sick days to add up to any leave after these urgent life events. And so I'm hoping to convince him that there is some things today that can only be done with Democrats. And I think it's universality and it's an earned benefit. There's no Republican that I've spoken to that wants a universal program or an earned benefit program. They're happy to support drawing down early on Social Security or voluntary programs or tax credits, but not this one thing that the House put in their bill. So I'm going to hopefully meet with them this week for one last go. And I'm hoping in the interim that a lot of people from West Virginia have talked to him, businesses, small businesses, parents, caregivers, that they've had a chance to make the case directly to him.
So what do you think? Are you going to get the Build Back Better bill passed before Christmas?
I'm hopeful, and I always believe in Christmas miracles. I always believe the goodwill of the season has a special magic that brings people together and gives us the opportunity of getting things done. It's how we passed the first 9/11 health bill. It's how we repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It was these Christmas miracles that make a difference, so I'm hopeful.
Is Senator Sinema a yes now and only Joe Manchin is not on board, or is it still both of them?
It's my understanding that Senator Sinema has signed off on the framework and how we're paying for these bills. She put her work in on this early, and I think she's in a good place. So I think it's really just Senator Manchin. And it seems to me from the public statements he said most recently that he's just worried about making sure these bills are paid for, and they are, and he wants to see the final text. And I think there's six main provisions in this bill, and four already, you know, the ink is dry. I think there's two that are still being written, one very importantly being the part where paid leave is in it. So I think they're still drafting that measure, and I think they're still drafting the green energy provisions, which are areas where Joe Manchin has strong opinions.
Listener tweets, really? It's a good sign that she has to explain to a grown man, let alone a U.S. senator, what paid leave is? Oh, brother, gross that we have to appeal to a man's ego to provide basic human rights. So that's a tweet from one listener. But of course, we talk about Senator Manchin all the time. We don't talk as much about the Republicans, none of whom are going to vote for any version of this bill. And I was wondering, on the climate provisions, when something like the Kentucky tornadoes hit, and the officials there say it's the worst ever such event. 200 miles of one tornado being on the ground had never been seen there before. And meteorologists are saying there is no smoking gun that climate change contributed, but there is a lot of smoke. I saw a quote like that. In the context of increasing warmth in December, contributing to the conditions for it. And last year also had a third more tornadoes there than the average for the 20-year period in the late 90s and early 00s. Does Mitch McConnell, who represents Kentucky, just continue to tell his troops in the Senate to keep blocking climate bills?
You know, it's hard to fathom the unwillingness to see the facts for what they are because, you know, over 70 people have already lost their lives. They think the death toll is going to be in excess of 100. That is families destroyed. And this is just heartbreaking. I mean, we lived through it in our own state, Brian, when we saw all the different superstorms come through our state right. and the death toll they left. We have to do something to reverse these trends. We have to take global climate change seriously before it's irreversible. And this bill has a chance to begin to do that. We have a chance of writing into legislation the greatest investment in green energy, renewable fuels, energy efficiency, green housing, green buildings, everything that changes the trajectory of this nation and the world. And we can put a price on carbon. So these are real implementable ideas that can be in this bill right now. And I'm actually optimistic that we can do this Dem-only vote and propel this forward. I have not given up hope on that, and I don't know why this is not shared. But if we do create this opportunity now, there are some things we can do on a bipartisan basis to build on it. There's lots of opportunities for energy efficiency and supporting businesses that go green, and those things can be done on a bipartisan basis.
Dan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Senator Gillibrand. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how you doing? Here's my question, Senator. What's more integral to human infrastructure than voting rights? I'm concerned of this issue that it's been silenced and put on the back burner. And as we talked about a lot on the show, if we don't have that, we lose the whole game. What's being done to keep that a priority? And I'm going to take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Dan.
So, Dan, you're exactly right, and I promise you it is not on the back burner. We talk about voting rights every week in our caucus meeting. We've been working with Senator Manchin specifically on voting rights as another must-do by the end of the year. And again, we need his consent. It's something that he has to want to have a rules change on. It requires all 50 Democrats to vote yes. So this is something where we've listened to his concerns. We let him draft the changes that he wants to support. He believed he could get Republican support. The only Republican he was able to convince was Lisa Murkowski. Obviously, that's not enough for 60. And I think the thought of allowing time to pass and allowing these attempts to go forward over and over and over again without Republican support, I think demonstrates effectively that we need to do this now with Democratic-only support. And hopefully that will be something that Senator Manchin will agree with at some point, maybe by the end of the year, maybe in the new year. But we need his support, and we're ready. And we're using a lot of our goodwill and a lot of our best advocacy to get that full 50 votes towards amending the rules to protect voting rights with a 50-vote threshold. You have to amend the filibuster rule to do it, and I fully support that.
And in the intro, I mentioned the Mark Meadows subpoena and Laura Ingraham to Meadows text message news items. I know you're not specifically on a January 6th committee, but one way to look at the coming next few elections is whether rejection of real results and even pro-Republican violence are really the biggest threats to the people right now. Yes?
I think it's a serious concern, and I think these hearings that the House is doing and this investigation is vital and extremely important, and the text messages that were revealed from Mark Meadows are deeply disturbing, and the question you asked about various Fox News hosts and what penalty they should pay for lying to the American people on television, I think it's a serious question, and I hope that it is asked, and I hope the American people demand an answer.
And so you're hoping that the filibuster can be suspended just for this issue. Is that what you were saying a minute ago?
Yes, I think that is a fair compromise to meet the needs of Senator Manchin, who does not want to amend the filibuster, but asking him amend it for this one thing, because we've tried and failed to do it on a bipartisan basis, and we've demonstrated in good faith that we've tried and failed to do it on a bipartisan basis, and so there is no way. And without protecting voting rights, you have no democracy. It's fundamental, just as your caller said, it's fundamental to the infrastructure of our whole country. If you don't have a democracy and you can't protect our democracy from the whims of an elected official who says I should be able to overturn any election results I want just because I said so, that needs protection. And so we have to do everything we can to strengthen and support voting rights in every respect. And so I fully support amending the voting rights. I fully support amending the filibuster to do that. I also support amending the filibuster to do a lot of other urgent issues like immigration reform and stopping gun violence and several other things. But given that this is a question for Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema, who oppose amending the filibuster, if the compromise ends up amend it for one thing, I think voting rights is the highest priority at this point.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand with us in our monthly Call Your Senator segment. We could also call it Tweet Your Senator. And here's a tweet that I mentioned at the top I would ask you about. Please ask Senator Gillibrand if she supports the Penn Station Neighborhood Destruction Plan, as this listener calls it. They write, we need a new Penn Station, not a new neighborhood. Thanks. So is this something that you as a senator would even weigh in on, or is that more for state and city officials?
Well, I might weigh in on it, but I would need to know a lot more about what the caller is talking about. But I do know we need a new Penn Station for sure. It needs to be improved and upgraded, and the facilities need investment. That is for certain. But based on what the caller says, I would question why would you need to destroy neighborhoods. So I will definitely look into it, and I will see what's happening on the ground and try to see if my help is needed there. But thank you, caller, for raising the issue to me.
I want to ask you about another issue that I know you've been heavily involved with, and we've talked about a lot when you've come on, military justice reform. And this year's big defense authorization bill has passed. And from what I read, your provisions to deal more honestly with commanders' conflict of interest in sexual assault and other military conduct issues were taken out of the bill behind closed doors. Can you give us an update?
Yes. So this is very disappointing. Obviously, I've been working on military justice reform for a very long time, for the past 8 years. And based on survivors' stories and the desires and hopes of constitutional experts and military justice experts, what we wanted to do was remove all serious crimes, excluding military crimes, from the chain of command and give the decision-making about whether those crimes need to be pursued and brought to court-martial, give those decisions to trained military prosecutors independent of the chain of command. And we wanted to do this bright line at all serious crimes, at felonies, and that was our bill, essentially. And what the DOD did was try to limit that change to just a couple of crimes. They just wanted it for sexual assault and a couple of related crimes. And they wanted this independent prosecutor to only retain some authority, just the authority to decide whether to prosecute. But a lot of the other authority that rests with the commander stayed with the commander. The commander is designated the convening authority. It's a term of art in the military that designates authorities such as pretrial restraint, separation authority, preliminary inquiry, the ability to actually convene the court-martial, preliminary hearings, choosing members of the jury panels, order depositions, and many other privileges like granting immunity, granting clemency. Anyway, unfortunately, the DOD got its way, and so even though we got these independent prosecutors put in the House bill that winded up being the final bill, they are not entirely independent of the chain of command because the convening authority is still resting with the commander. And so the independent prosecutor gets one decision point. They get to decide whether to prosecute, and that's it. And then all these other rights and privileges that I mentioned still rest with the commander. So the thing that's disturbing is that from the perspective of a survivor, he or she may not believe that this new independent prosecutor, despite the label independent, mm-hmm. and despite that its decision can't be changed by the commander, without all these other authorities, they may not be perceived as independent. And I don't know if under these changes, then more will report. Only about a third of these of survivors report these crimes. I don't know if the number of cases that end in retaliation will change. I don't know if the percentage of cases that will end in conviction will change. We'll see. But it's a disappointment, and it's one that the DOD orchestrated very intentionally to make sure that the status quo was maintained and that commanders retained their authority.
So what is that, do you think? I mean, is it as simple as the patriarchy of these mostly male commanders blatantly protecting these mostly male accused who they see as their brothers? Or is it more subtle than that?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I think it's they like to have control. It's about control. And they're not trained. Commanders aren't lawyers. They're not prosecutors. And they're not independent. And so survivors believe that justice isn't possible. It's a perception issue. And unfortunately, on the opposite side, from the defendant's right side, many black and brown service members believe that they also don't get a fair shake if they are a defendant. They also perceive bias in the military. And so you've got perception of bias by both plaintiffs and defendants in different cases. And so the whole benefit of this bright line reform was that you might have fixed the whole system. You might have just put in place something that put independent prosecutors in place that are highly trained. So that would have given the opportunity to remove bias. It might have created justice for plaintiffs and defendants. It might have created a more professional system for everybody. And that's why we pushed so hard for it. And that's why it's so disappointing that the DOD just couldn't let go, and they just couldn't let go of command authority and just couldn't give the convening authority to these new independent prosecutors. And it's just a shame. It was a moment in time where we had all the support we needed. We had 66 senators. We had 220 House members, a majority on both sides. Yeah. We had every veterans group endorsing it. We had 29 attorneys general. We had Speaker Pelosi. We had Leader Schumer. We even had Minority Leader McConnell. We had everybody supporting this bill. And again, for the chairman and rankers for the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House Armed Services Committee to exert their will, which was really the DOD's preference over all these other areas of support, just was very disappointing.
One last thing for you, Senator, and on a lighter note, I think it's a lighter note, unless it becomes interplanetary war existential threat stuff. But for now, maybe a lighter note. I see the Senate did include your amendment to study unidentified aerial phenomena in the Defense Authorization Bill. Does that mean you think we've been visited by distant beings?
You know, finally, you picked a non-controversial topic. Thank you, Brian. So this amendment is very exciting, and one that I'm very, very, very excited about working on. So unidentified aerial phenomenon, or as the kids like to call it, UFOs. We in the defense committee, as well as the Intel committee, have been getting some reports over some years that are not very thorough, and they're inadequate, in my opinion, about when service members, particularly our pilots, our Air Force pilots and our naval pilots, have witnessed some kind of aerial phenomenon that they have lots of sensors and detectors to actually document. So whether they're documenting through video or heat sensors or radar, they're able to document it. And then we aren't able to actually identify it. We don't know what it is. We don't know if it's some light or, you know, usually we can identify these things as, oh, it's a weather balloon, or, oh, it's a drone, or, oh, it's an aircraft. Like, we can figure it out. Or it's just the way the light hit the water in this place here. I mean, we usually can figure it out, but there's been instances in the past 5 years where we can't figure it out. And the DOD published a report publicly, I think in June, that said there was something like 150 things they couldn't identify. And so I am the chair of the personnel subcommittee. And the one thing I really don't like is that when a service member comes forward and shows what they saw, that they're denigrated in some way, that they're disbelieved in some way, or they're doubted, or they're made fun of, or somehow their reputation is harmed. That's unacceptable to me. We ask our airmen to report anything they see that's out of the ordinary, because we need to know where threats are, especially from adversaries. We want to know if there's Chinese technology or Russian technology that we're unaware of. We need to know what they're developing. We need to know everything. This is what we need to do to protect our country. So I asked for this amendment, and some very thoughtful people helped me write it, and it creates a new section, a new area within the DOD that is going to collect and analyze the data into a central repository. This office will supervise the development and execution of a real intelligence collection and analysis of these sightings and of these unidentified aerial phenomenon, and will be able to better understand what are the technical and scientific characteristics to help us assess what they are, and to be able to put them in categories, like this is likely technology from an adversary, or it's truly unknown. We just need to know which buckets they go in, and to be able to create a pathway for people to be able to report this information. There's also information that's publicly available. There's information through FAA. There's information through the scientific community. And all of that information needs to be collected and garnered into one place. And then we can build a national framework to create priorities for analyzing and assessing. And that's what it is. So it's going to be fun. It's going to be interesting. And it's something that certainly my kids think is cool, so I can at least get a favorable mom award once in a while.
Yes, and I hear these things may be more likely from Shanghai than from Saturn, but nevertheless a point of rare non-controversial consensus, as you said. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, we always appreciate when you come on with us. Look forward to talking with you next month. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Thank you, and you be well and be safe, and I'll see you soon. God bless.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.